Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum again this hour. Jimmy Akin again this hour, and lots of people already on the lines. I'll tell you what, there's one line open though. If you're a Catholic, non-Catholic, or other, and you have a question about the Catholic faith, the Catholic Church, Catholic people, the Bible, the sacraments, a moral question, all of those are welcome. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. And we had a little fun at the break. We talked to the people on the internet.
Yeah.
Which is a kind of a cool, fun thing to do.
Yeah, and they heard us. I mean, we can always talk to them, but they may not hear us.
That is correct. I have heard
It's like I can talk to you anytime I want, but if you're not in the room or on the phone with me, you won't hear me probably.
Have you ever heard the expression that it's perfectly fine to talk to yourself?
Yeah, of course.
You're in trouble if you listen.
I haven't heard that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to ask you this, Jimmy, before we go back to phones.
I've never thought that talking to yourself is a sign of mental illness is – I mean, that's not of itself a sign of mental illness,
no.
Period. There's nothing crazy about talking when you're alone.
No, and sometimes you see it in particularly intense people who – it just seems like the internal dialogue or the internal conversation got intense, and so it came out. And
Or they're doing it for fun or whatever, but we have an internal monologue going on all the time in our heads when we're conscious.
Yeah.
And so it's totally normal. Just saying it out loud may violate social customs or maybe a little odd if someone walks in and you're talking to yourself, but there's nothing crazy about it.
No, it seems
now,
like
now screaming at a shopping cart, you know.
Man, have you ever gotten that one with the wobbly wheel? Though, tell me you don't scream at it at that point. That's right. And it used to be that if someone was speaking in a loud voice in public and no one else was around, you thought, well, that would suggest something's going on, like a delusion or a.
Yeah.
But now it's just they're on their phone. Ken in San Antonio, Texas. Listening on Guadalupe Radio, you are up first this hour. Your question for Jimmy.
How you doing? I'm a first-time caller.
Happy to have you, Ken.
Thank you. My question is, I was baptized. I'm a Christian, and I was baptized as a young boy in North Carolina at a Baptist church, Fellowship Free Will Baptist Church.
Uh-huh.
And I read the Bible nightly, and the comfort that the Bible gives me when I read it is like no other. It relaxes me. It takes away a lot of my worries and the daily routine. And I do believe in the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ in heaven.
Awesome.
I've read all the Bible.
How can we help?
And I'm just wondering, sometimes I question my faith because even though I'm a Christian, I still fear death.
Oh. Well, you shouldn't question your faith on that basis. God built us so that we have a negative emotional reaction to death. That's something that he wanted to be part of our nature so that we would avoid death and seek to preserve our lives. So it's built into us, and it is entirely natural and healthy to have negative emotional associations with death and the dying process and to want to avoid that, and that's what motivates us to avoid dying. In fact, we can see that in the Gospels, Jesus himself had this as part of his human nature. He was averse to death. He had death aversion. We see that in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he is intensely praying, and he says, "Father, if it's your will, you know, let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but yours be done." And so he submits himself to God's will, but he confesses emotionally he is not looking forward to this. And so so Jesus, as someone with a human nature, had the aversion to death and the dying process and the suffering that involves that we all have and that God wants us to have. So there may be individuals who, when they're dying, they're totally at peace and they're totally fearless. But if so, that's a special grace that they've been given by God that goes beyond just human nature to help them in that moment. For most people, though, they need that avoidance of death instinct to be functioning. And the name for that avoidance of death instinct that we have is fear. Fear is what motivates us to avoid things.
Does that give you any comfort?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, good.
Thank you so much.
No problem. Keep listening and call again.
Thank you.
All right. God bless you, brother. Let us go then to John in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. John, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. My question is just something my family and I talk about a lot. We go to church in a conservative diocese, which is awesome. You know, we only have altar boys. We only have Eucharistic ministers or acolytes that are males. And then you can go, you know, 15 miles down the road to a different diocese that has totally different things. And I guess my question, the thing we always wonder is, as a one holy Catholic and apostolic church, how can things be so different from diocese to diocese? It doesn't change the faith. It's just something we all wonder in my family, how things can be so different when we're so close to each other.
Okay, so the basic answer is God willed that there be diversity in his church. He willed that there be unity so that we'd all be one body sharing one faith, but he also willed that there would be diversity. And that's something that you can show any number of ways. But one way of showing it is by looking at what St. Paul has to say. If you read, for example, Romans 12, or even more significantly, 1 Corinthians 12 to 14, Paul talks about how we all have different spiritual gifts, and that's by God's design. He compares the church as the body of Christ to a human body that has many different body parts, and they're not all the same. They don't all perform the same function. And he says, just like we have eyes and ears and feet and stuff on our bodies, so the members of Christ's body, the church, are all different from each other. And that's actually good. He says, if the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? And if the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? We need these different gifts or different abilities and different inclinations that people have. And it applies not only to the supernatural gifts that the Holy Spirit gives us, but it applies to other things like our native talents. Just look at people. We don't all look the same. We don't all have the same emotional temperament. That diversity that God has built into human nature actually is a strength. You know what would happen if we were all like clones of each other, if we were all genetically identical? Do you know what would happen, Psychelet?
I'm thinking mass death.
Mass death would happen because as soon as a single fatal virus came along that could kill a person with one set of genes, it would kill everybody because everybody would have the same set of genes. So actually, within a given community, having diversity, as long as it doesn't destroy or harm the community, having diversity is a strength. And that's true for the Christian community as well as society at large. And so God wanted people to be different. And he wanted there to be diversity within the one faith, including how it's practiced. And that's been the case ever since the first century. So you would have right there in the first century, you'd have some Christians who spoke Aramaic, and you'd have other Christians who spoke Greek, and others who spoke Latin, and others who spoke Egyptian. And you'd have some Christians who were circumcised and some Christians who weren't. You'd have some Christians who were free and some Christians who were slaves. You'd have some Christians who practiced the liturgy according to one form. And you'd have other Christians who practiced it according to a different form because the liturgy hadn't been standardized yet. It was still developing. And so this diversity is something that's always been there. And the pastors of the church, i.e. the bishops and the pope, have to use their judgment in discerning, okay, well, given the set of people in my diocese, those are the people I need to reach. Those are the people I'm shepherd of. How do I best serve them? And what choices do I make in terms of, say, are we going to have altar boys or altar girls? What's going to facilitate people's tranquility with the faith and their union with Christ and his church more? The answer to that may not be the same everywhere. It may not be the same in your part of Nebraska as it would be, say, in Berkeley, California. if the bishop in Berkeley, California said, guess what, we're not going to have altar girls, just altar boys, that could alienate a bunch of people in Berkeley from the church, especially in the short run. And so these decisions need to be made by the prudent judgment of the pastors. But in terms of why is there a diversity of practice, it's because God wanted people to be different.
Oh, and thank you very, very much for that question, John. I do appreciate it. Let us go to we got to take a quick break. Sorry about that. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right here on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
A skeptic once engaged me in conversation saying, yeah, I'm skeptical about everything. To which I replied, are you skeptical about that? And I actually got a chuckle out of his girlfriend standing nearby. You see, the claim, I doubt everything, refutes itself. If a skeptic doubts everything, well, then he must doubt the claim, I doubt everything. Which, of course, is the same as saying, I doubt that I doubt everything. This is absurd. If a skeptic doubts his own assertion, I doubt everything, well, then why even put it forward? Suppose my skeptic friend retorted, no, I'm certain I doubt everything. Well, this wouldn't help him either, because there would be one thing he doesn't doubt, namely the claim, I doubt everything. No matter how a radical skeptic approaches his skepticism, whether he doubts it or affirms it, he ends in a self-contradiction. I'm Carlo Broussard with a ready reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
What makes me happy is listening to Catholic radio. I'm by myself a lot, had a concussion as a child, and I can't see very well, but I do work, I go to church, and I'm an on-fire convert, and as a child, more or less, I've learned to have a good sense of humor whenever I can, and I'm very appreciative of everything I have, and especially Catholic radio.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
We got a huge, giant, magnificent Catholic Answers Conference coming up September 26th to 29th right here in beautiful, sunny San Diego. It is about the best time of the year to be in San Diego is September. It's my personal favorite month. I hope you'll come and join us. The theme of the conference is the early church was the Catholic Church. And for about a month more, we've got early bird pricing on it. So go ahead and get your tickets if you're thinking about coming. The full conference ticket includes the banquet dinner with our keynote speaker, Bishop Frank Caggiano from Bridgeport, Connecticut. Rod Bennett is going to be a speaker. Father David McConey is going to be a speaker. Monsignor Eugene Morris is going to be a speaker. Our own Jimmy Akin, Trent Horn, Carlo Broussard, and Tim Staples will be speakers. But I think the highlight that everyone is looking forward to, Jimmy, is
the square dancing.
Square dancing.
Yeah.
Did you have fun doing that last year?
Oh, yeah. I had a lot of fun. Looking forward to doing it. It was such a big hit, they said, we need to do it again this year. So
okay.
Looking forward to calling some dances for folks.
And I noticed that not all of the music was like old-timey.
Oh, no.
You have some very contemporary music in there.
Yeah. Today, I mean, I called a lot of different kinds of dance, including others besides square dancing. But even in square dancing, in modern Western square dancing, you have all kinds of music that gets used. I have world beat things that I'll call dances to. For example, I have a piece by a Danish group singing in English pretending to be from Japan that I call to. And it's like techno, Euro, Japan pop.
I don't even
English.
Know what to say sometimes, Jimmy. I don't even know what to say. Like, I'd be curious. I'm not going to ask you now on the air, but sometime I'd like to know where you even came across that piece of music.
Yeah. Well, I got it in caller school. It's by, it's called the Rigadigga Ding Dong Song. Oh, well, no, there's two of them actually that I'm thinking of. One of them is the Rigadigga Ding Dong Song by Passion Fruit, which was a European band. And then there's also one called Butterfly, which is the one by the Europeans pretending to be Japanese but singing in English.
And you'll be preparing so much for calling this square dance, you won't even be able to give your usual well-prepared, highly competent talk.
Oh, I can call dances in my sleep. In fact,
really?
I do.
Even when your soul is asleep?
I write choreography in my sleep, and then I wake up and write it down. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. So, but you will be given a talk.
Yes, I will.
And it'll be on?
The very first church fathers, the very earliest.
I'm really looking forward to this. Like Polycarp?
even earlier.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I got to hear, because you, I know you wrote a book.
I mean, Polycarp, he's like 108 AD. There's earlier fathers than that.
Really? But I heard that Polycarp heard the Apostle John preach. Is that true?
It's possible.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. It's one of the possibilities. Because you wrote a book called The Fathers Know Best, Your Essential Guide to the Teachings of the Early Church. So who could be a church father earlier than
Clement of Rome?
Oh.
And there are other early Christian writers too, like Hermas.
Oh, yeah, who wrote The Shepherd.
The Shepherd, yeah.
Okay.
It's such a fun book, The Shepherd. It's just, for people who don't know, it's a first century private revelation. Hermas is this guy. He's an ex-slave. He's gotten married and has children. He's become a prosperous businessman. And he starts having visions of the church as a beautiful woman. And then an angel, the angel of repentance, comes to live with him and shows him these visions. And it's really just a fun book. Hermas is such an innocent guy.
You know, I until you told me that, actually, I hadn't read The Shepherd of Hermas.
Because
you had recommended it as a really fun read. And it really is. It's like it's a story. It's
I liken the vision where he's walking down the road and he starts having a vision. This is out in the countryside outside of Rome.
Yeah.
And he's walking down the road. He starts having a vision and this giant monster that's multicolored that symbolizes persecution starts just cascading down the road toward him. And he hears a voice saying, like, Hermas, remember your faith. And as soon as he remembers his faith, the monster like shuts up and gets subservient.
Yeah.
And it's like how Christians triumph over persecution.
It's beautiful. All right. So we're going to hear about the earliest church fathers from you. All right. And that's going to be at our conference called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, coming up this September 26th through 29th at the beautiful Hyatt Regency La Jolla right here in sunny San Diego. Just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com, CatholicAnswersConference.com, and be a part of it. We're expecting about you and about 1,000 other people. So that's what we're looking forward to, and it's a lot of fun. I want to say, before we go to our next caller, hello to Javier in Shanghai, because I know Javier listens all the time in Shanghai.
Cool.
And I always forget to say hi to him. I don't even know if we have other listeners in Chinese, they don't say Shanghai. They say Shanghai, I think. But anyways.
I don't know. I haven't taken enough Mandarin. I've taken a little bit, but it's been a long time.
I watched a Chinese movie last night called The Wandering Earth. Have you seen it yet? The Wandering Earth?
No.
It's a Chinese science fiction movie.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the first PG movie I ever saw was a Chinese science fiction movie.
What was that?
Inframan.
Oh, I've never even heard of that one.
Yeah. It's kind of like a think 1970s Hong Kong really silly version of Iron Man.
That's
sense. Okay. He battles the forces, all these monsters that are being sent by Princess Dragon Mom.
Oh man, I got to see that. The Wandering Earth is a little more contemporary. Okay, back to the phones.
The Earth does wander.
Oh,
it even precesses.
Yeah, but in this one, it really wanders. Like it heads out towards Jupiter.
Oh, and, that's not good.
No, it's not until they figure out how to.
It's like that episode of The Twilight Zone.
I don't want to give it away.
She's on Earth and it's like the Earth is falling towards the sun and it's all like burning up and it's so hot and she's just sweating like crazy. And then at the end of the episode,
dun, dun, dun.
The twist is she's actually asleep. She's got a fever and the Earth is actually moving away from the sun and is getting colder.
And that's pretty much exactly how a Twilight Zone is supposed to end.
Yep.
Give us that little twist right there at the end. Eric in Hamilton, New Jersey, you are up next with Jimmy Akin. Your question, Eric.
Yes, can you hear me?
We can, Eric.
Yeah, just so folks know, you don't need to ask if we can hear you. If we can't, we'll turn you up.
Okay. Well, my phone's acting a little funny. I have to yell into it to be heard. So.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, yeah, my question was about the priesthood. If a priest is like defrocked or kicked out of the church, does he still have the ability to perform the sacraments?
Okay.
And
well,
okay.
What's the second question?
Question about the Celtic Catholic Church and its relationship to the Roman Catholic Church.
Okay. So in regard to the first question, defrocked is a kind of a casual, informal slang term that gets used for when a priest has his is suspended from being able to perform the sacraments. And so it's not the technical term that's used in canon law, but it's the one you hear in the press. It does not mean being kicked out of the church. The church doesn't kick people out. It may apply various penalties to them if they've done something really wrong, but it never expels them from the church altogether. Not even excommunication does that. Excommunication restricts a person's ability to do certain things in the church, but it doesn't make them a non-Catholic. The church is not in the business of kicking people out and, you know, pushing them away from the church in that way. It will, though, discipline them when they do something wrong and need to be corrected. Whether it's because he's done something wrong or simply because he's decided the priesthood isn't for him, if a priest leaves the clerical state, either as a punishment, he could be expelled from the clerical state, or he could just request it. He's not allowed to perform the sacraments anymore, with one exception. If there's someone who's dying, he can hear that person's confession, because the church wants to make confession available to every single dying person so that they can have the opportunity of you know, being reconciled with God even at the moment of death. And so if he's there and someone is dying and that person wants him to hear their confession, he can hear their confession. But it's only in that kind of emergency circumstance that he can do that. Otherwise, he cannot perform the sacraments. In terms of the other question about the Celtic Catholic Church, this is a body that claims, obviously, to be both Celtic and Catholic. It's actually based here in the United States, and it claims to have apostolic succession from a 17th century Archbishop of Canterbury, who was an archbishop in the Anglican Church. So that right there is a problem for them having valid holy orders. But it's not even clear that they have such succession, because there is apparently no evidence of them existing before the 1960s. And so they're a recent body that is claiming to have this succession. But even if they had it, it wouldn't be valid from a Catholic point of view.
Thank you very, very much for that call and for that question, Eric. We appreciate it. Up next is Willie in Columbia, South Carolina, listening on St. Joseph Radio. Willie, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes. I want to know, I remember when the Bible says that when Jesus told his disciples to go out and proclaim the gospel to the whole world. Hello?
Yeah, we got you.
Yeah,
go ahead, Willie.
You're okay, on the air. What's the question?
Romans 11, Paul is talking about inclusiveness, bringing, you know, the Gentiles into the kingdom, God's kingdom, and making the Jews jealous. I don't understand that.
Okay. Jealous is not necessarily the best English way to communicate what's going on, but it actually does a pretty good job. The idea is that and St. Paul talks about this elsewhere. He talks about how he makes much of his ministry to the Gentiles in order to win over some Jews. And the idea, when he says makes much of, he means he talks a lot about it. And so he goes out, he converts Gentiles. Then when he's among Jews, he talks about how much the Gentiles are responding to God's grace and to God's gospel. And the reason he does that is because he wants the Jews to get on fire for God too, and to take their heritage seriously and their faith seriously, and to accept Jesus as the Messiah. And he uses what's happening with the Gentiles as a way of trying to win over Jews. And that's essentially what he's talking about in Romans 11. He says that because the Gentiles are coming into God's church, because they're responding to the gospel and becoming believers in Jesus, that has the potential to make Jews jealous of the same thing, to want the same thing. And so that's what he's hoping will happen, is that the fact that Gentiles are becoming Christians will help Jews to also want to become Christians and to accept Jesus as their Messiah. Because after all, Jesus is their Messiah. He himself was a Jew.
Now, Willie, does that address what you wanted to get at?
That's good. Because anyway, a lot of the Jews, there are certain Jews still don't believe Jesus is the Messiah, right?
That's correct. There are Jews who do believe that Jesus is the Messiah, but there are also Jews who unfortunately don't yet believe that Jesus is the Messiah. But hopefully one day.
Thanks so much, Willie. I'm concerned about Catholics who don't believe Jesus is the Messiah. I think we've got...
You'd have to be pretty uneducated Catholics not to believe that.
Well, I just think we have a tendency towards syncretism, I guess, a little bit of, well, you know, all these religious leaders are the same. You know, that kind
of... Well, that's indifferentism.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
But they might still think he's the Messiah, but who cares?
Yeah, who cares? Right, who cares about the Messiah? Okay, Willie, thanks again for that call. It is open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we will be right back with more of your calls for Jimmy on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Harry Connick Jr., and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew she wanted those things, that in them, somehow, she would find God. Over the years, as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Our content provided by the callers. You're welcome to ask any question you've got about the Catholic faith, about Catholic people, or about religion or ethics or philosophy more generally.
Weird stuff.
Oh, well, I always wait too long to get to this, so I'm going to say this right now. Mm-hmm. Jimmy is also the podcaster behind the podcast called Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
One of the two with my co-host Don Bettinelli.
Right. And I forgot on Friday to listen to the Fatima one.
Oh, yeah.
Was that Monday that it dropped?
No, it was Friday. Every Friday a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World comes out. And last Friday was Fatima.
Yeah.
There's a new one tomorrow.
Do you want to give us any clue about what's coming out this Friday?
I'll tell you exactly what it is.
Oh, that's tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow. But, it's the secret Pentagon UFO study project known as ATIP, which has released to the public gun camera footage of unidentified aerial things. They do not know what they are, and that outperform anything we've got.
You know, this brings up a question I've always wanted to ask you, uh-huh. And this is an actual Catholic Answers question, so I'm inserting myself into the queue now to ask you an open forum question. There was a movie years ago, it was a joke movie, it was a comedy movie about an alien who came to the Earth.
Okay.
And the
there have been a number of those.
The Christians in the movie were very afraid of the alien and it upset them.
Hmm.
And the alien said, "That's because my existence overturns a belief in an Abrahamic God." And I thought,
what a lame line of dialogue.
Okay, so I wondered about that. Like, there's nothing about an alien coming to Earth which would overturn the Bible or anything.
No.
Okay, I just wanted to run that by you.
No, it's also just a piece of wooden dialogue, if that's the way they said it.
It was some, well, I probably, it was a paraphrase.
I mean, like, how would the alien even know the term Abrahamic God?
Oh, he was very savvy, and he had been on Earth for like 30 years.
Oh,
so,
well, he might have learned it in that time.
But. Yeah, or Abrahamic religion or something. He said, yeah, it overturns thousands.
No, it has nothing to do. If God, I mean, okay, so God makes Abraham. God appears to Abraham. How does that stop God from also making aliens somewhere else?
Right, right. I'm not a believer in aliens.
You're
myself.
Not?
No, mm-hmm. Except for angels.
Okay.
But I'm waiting for the I don't know. I actually don't know why.
So,
I think it's just a contrary position.
So
I think I take it just to be contrarian, frankly.
Okay. So do you think there are no intelligent aliens anywhere, or just they haven't come here?
Oh, I don't think there's any intelligent aliens.
Okay.
I think
there
there's probably life.
Unintelligent aliens, like microbes or something.
Yeah,
somewhere.
That kind of
okay.
thing. I do think that seems likely.
Uh-huh.
And I got no reason for that except – maybe just I like being a contrarian.
Okay.
Because it seems like everybody goes nowadays, well, there's so many planets and so many stars, there has to be life. And I feel like that's actually not an argument. That's just an assertion. Mm. And not just life, but intelligent life.
Uh-huh.
And so then I get all fussy and go the other direction. But I have nothing more to support my view,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Okay. Well, there are arguments that the kind of environment – you need to have a place like Earth is very rare.
Yeah.
It's called the rare Earth hypothesis.
Right.
And there are some people who will argue like we're the only intelligent life in the galaxy.
No.
Others will say, no, there's got to be more. But, you know, there are people who argue that. And then there will be others who argue we're the only intelligent life in the universe.
That's more my view.
But that's usually for – if it's supported by argument, it's usually for more theological reasons than scientific reasons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But mine is for no reason.
Okay.
It's just my...
just your inclination.
Yeah, my inclination is in that direction, yes. Kyle, watching on YouTube live. I'm sorry, Kyle. I was just having trouble figuring out which button to push. You're up next, Kyle. Go ahead. Your question.
Hi,
Kyle.
My question is regarding a parish's rights, I guess.
Okay.
Back in December, our priest... Say again?
Okay.
Hold on. Yeah. Our priest was put on a leave of absence for, it was very vague accusations that we were told about. It was just that he broke the code of conduct with minors and that it wasn't sexual in nature. That's all that was given to us.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's been on a leave of absence since then. We've had a visiting priest from the diocese, and he gives us very minimal information. Really, all he says is he's doing well.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask him, and the parish is getting to a point where we're losing members now. Our finances have started to fall off a little bit because there's some disgruntled people who have stopped giving to the offertory, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And
how can I help? What's your question for me?
Under canon law, when there's an investigation going on for the priest, does the parish have any rights, and should they be given any sort of transparency with the?
Okay, that's very
so,
clear. Thank you.
In terms of does the parish have rights? Well, the people who go to the parish have rights under Catholic moral theology to, you know, they have a right in the first place to be protected and from all kinds of different things, including non-sexual things. And so it's removing a priest from a parish while an investigation is going on is intended to do just that, to protect people who in the parish who have rights to be protected. So that of itself is it's a prudential application of the underlying moral principles that are in play in this situation. But the people in the parish aren't the only ones who have rights. The priest also has rights, including, especially if he's innocent, a right to his good name. And legally, he also has a presumption of innocence. And so just because an accusation gets made, that may mean you need to take to investigate the situation, but it doesn't mean you automatically condemn someone. You know, it's the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So if you wouldn't want all of the details of an accusation against you told to everybody you know and work with while it's still being investigated and is still unproven, then you shouldn't expect all of the details that of an accusation that's been made against someone else to be told to everyone while an investigation is still underway and they're still unproven. So so I would say, you know, it's understandable that people would want more information than they have. But how much information they should be given is going to be a matter of prudence. The priest, especially if he turns out to be innocent, he needs to not have his reputation destroyed by having all kinds of, you know, accusations, whether of a sexual nature or a non-sexual nature, as in this case, being told to everybody he knows and works with. He may want a certain amount of information to be shared just so people don't leap to the worst possible conclusion. You know, yeah. I can imagine a priest saying, being told, okay, we're going to have to take you out of the parish while we do this investigation. And he knows it's not a sexual allegation, but he knows if he's just taken out and people learn there's an investigation that they're going to think it's about sex.
Yeah.
And so I could easily imagine a priest saying, please tell them this is not about sex.
Yeah.
Let them know that much.
Right.
But still not wanting every single detail of the accusation to be shared with everyone while it's still unproven. So it's a tough situation when investigations like this have to happen, and there has to be a prudential balancing of the needs of people to know things, needs as opposed to wants.
Yes, right.
And the needs of the person who's been accused to due process and to his reputation, especially if he's innocent, turns out to be innocent.
And you do, Kyle. Thanks very much for the call. I hope that was helpful to you. I mean, you know, I've been in a situation where a school teacher in a school was taken, there is a kind of drama and upset that goes around it. But you have to be patient and wait. I mean, it happens when police officers are suspended, and it's just a fact. A lot of times, until everything's done, there's just not much to share.
Yeah.
All right, Kyle. Thank you. I hope that was helpful. Let us go to Dan in Indianapolis. Hi, Dan. Are you there with us?
Hello.
Your question for Jimmy, Dan.
Yes, I have a question regarding Luke chapter 17, verses 34 and 35, where Christ, in speaking about the end times, says, I tell you, in that night there will be two men in one bed, one will be taken and the other left. There will be two women grinding together, one will be taken and the other left. So I have friends that are very much pro-LGBT, and they repeatedly cite this verse to me as being justification for believing that Christ actually is perfectly acceptable towards homosexual conduct because of the verb grinding referring actually.
Oh, no.
All right. Well, yeah. I see where you're going, but
okay.
That's an interesting exegesis.
Yeah.
Let me put it that way.
So let's take a look at both parts of this. The first one, it doesn't in Greek actually say two men. It says two. There will be two in one bed. One will be taken and the other left. Now, in Greek, the word for two in this case is in the masculine, but it doesn't mean two men because masculine is the default gender you use when you're talking about groups of people. So just like in English, you know, if I am talking historically, now today people have different sensibilities in some cases, but historically, if I say something like all men have the right to be treated fairly, well, I'm including women in that.
Yes.
You know, I don't mean just persons of the male gender.
Right.
And the same thing is true in Greek. When you see the And it's also true in Spanish and other languages. Like if you talk about mis padres, well, okay, that's masculine, but it means my parents.
Yeah.
Even though it literally would be my fathers.
Right.
It's one of your fathers in this case is your mother. It's just the masculine is used as a default gender whenever you have two. So when Jesus says there will be two people in one bed, he means it'll be a couple. He could mean that it's a man and a woman. It's a husband and wife.
Mm-hmm.
That's the normal way you'd say it. You'd say there will be two in one bed, one will be taken and the other left. And he means a male and female couple. On the other hand, you know, sometimes people of the same gender do sleep in the same bed and sex is not involved at all. You know, this is something that is mentioned in the book of Proverbs about how if you've got, you know, a couple guys out in the country, it's cold at night, they may lie down under the same blanket so they can keep warm together. This happens, you know, all the time without sex being involved. It's our culture is a little different, but historically there's just not a presumption that if you have two people in the same bed of the same gender that they're going to be having sex. Growing up, I mean, you look back at even earlier in the previous century, you know, you'll see the Three Stooges in bed together.
Yeah.
You'll see all kinds of groups of people of the same gender, the Marx Brothers in bed together.
Right.
You'll see all kinds of things like that.
Even in the 19th century, if you were traveling and you stayed at an inn, you very often were in the same bed with another man, yeah, for example, or another woman. You got a bed.
Right.
Go to bed.
So there's an imposing of ideas from our culture inappropriately into a text about another culture.
Yeah.
Also, the grinding thing, it says the two women will be grinding grain together. And if you think that's any kind of a sexual reference, you really do not understand how people got food in the ancient world, because you had to grind grain in order to make bread, and bread was the key component of everybody's diet in this era, so much so that the Greek word for bread, arton, also just means food. Because bread was the overwhelming kind of food people ate. And it was a typical task of women to grind the grain that they would then use to make the bread. And so Jesus is just talking about two women grinding grain together when this disaster happens.
Dan, we will have to leave it there because we do have to take our last break of the hour. We'll be right back with more questions for Jimmy Akin. It is open forum and the lines are full. And we will try to get to as many as we can before the top of the hour. Right back after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
New on EWTN Radio, the Church Alive.
Yes, St. Monica, who I think is one of those great role models for so many mothers today.
My mother passed on to eternal life 8 years ago on the Feast of St. Monica. And, you know, what a powerful example for me, because I know she prayed me back to the church.
The Church Alive with Brian Patrick, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and Father Thomas Petrie. Saturday at 7 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Open forum, Jimmy Akin, Catholic Answers Live. We go now to Ezra in Fort Worth, Texas. Ezra, you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Your question, Ezra, for Jimmy.
My question is, I know everyone can become a saint,
mm-hmm.
and I know some angels are saints, but it seems to me like wouldn't every angel be a saint? Why only some of them?
Well, so there's sort of two aspects to this question. The first one is some angels are not saints because they rebelled against God and became demons. So those angels are not saints because they're not holy. All of the other angels, all of the angels who did not rebel and who stayed loyal to God, all of them are saints. So they're absolutely all of them are saints. That's why we have All Saints Day on the calendar to honor them, because all of the good angels are also saints, and they're included among the all saints that include the human saints. In terms of why do we only refer to certain angels who were saints as like Saint Michael and Saint Gabriel, it's because they're the ones whose names we know. We don't know the names of very many angels in the Bible. Only like three are named in the books that Catholics honor as scripture. And so but we know there are millions and millions and millions of angels, and we just don't know most of their names. And so we don't talk about, you know, Saint Bocephus or whoever the angel, because we don't know if there is a Saint Bocephus the angel.
Well, now there is, now that you've said it.
Well,
you just started something.
No, that's not how it works. Okay. And also, an angel does not get his wings when bells ring. That's okay. Hollywood stuff.
Ezra, how's that? Does that satisfy your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call, Ezra. Appreciate it. Let's go to Ken in Champaign, Illinois, listening on 95.7 FM. Ken, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have an unusual question.
Okay.
I have a dentist appointment coming up to pull a tooth. They've discovered there's bone loss underneath it, and mm-hmm. to repair that, they intend to use this bone matrix that is derived from human cadavers.
Uh-huh.
And I just didn't know if there's any problems involved with that sort of use of using that?
Not in principle. It's not intrinsically wrong to have a medical procedure where something from someone else's body is put into yours. I mean, that's what a blood transfusion is. You take, you know, blood from someone else's body and you put it in yours, and it helps you live or, you know, recover from an injury or whatever it may be. The same thing is true taking a bone matrix from a cadaver and putting it in your body is the same as a blood transfusion or an organ transplant. As long as the person who donated the bone did so willingly, and I would assume that they did, because it would be illegal to take someone's bone from their body after they died if they didn't donate it, or if, you know, their relative who speaks for them didn't give permission for it, then I would assume that whoever donated this bone, and it might even be more than one person, gave consent, in which case it puts it in the same category as any other kind of organ transplant or blood transfusion. If memory serves, it's only I think your own body will eventually replace the bone over the course of time.
Oh.
Just like if you get a blood transfusion, your body will eventually replace that blood with your own. So it may not even remain permanently. You'd have to check with your dentist on that. But there's no intrinsic moral problem here.
Okay. Feel all right now?
Well, my dentist explained that it does replace itself eventually. So you're right on that.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, you are okay, Ken. Yep. And God bless you as you undergo that surgery.
Hope they get you back to good dental health.
Up next, Josh in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, listening on the Ave Maria radio app. Josh, your question for Jimmy Akin. Josh? No. I mean, hey, hang on, Josh. If you're talking, it's possible. Sometimes I do push the wrong button at the end of the.
Also,
no, that was the right button.
It's important for people to listen to their phones, not their radios, when they're on hold, because there's a time delay. You won't hear us if you're listening to your radio when we put you on the air.
I bet you're there, Josh. Are you there now?
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
We can hear you. Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, awesome.
Your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, it's from my son, David. He's 9. He goes to a Catholic school, and there's an older boy there who's Lutheran.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't believe in purgatory, obviously. The Lutheran doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So my son asked, what do Lutherans teach about purgatory?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question.
Okay, so what do Lutherans teach about purgatory?
Luther himself did not like the idea of purgatory, and so he and the vast majority of Lutherans don't really use this concept in their theology. And they'll even say negative things about it. They'll say they don't believe in purgatory and so forth. But if you sit down with them and you say, well, wait a minute, are you perfectly holy when you die? Most of them will say, well, no, probably not. And then if you say, well, will you be perfectly holy when you're in heaven? they'll say, oh, yeah, definitely, we're not going to be sinning in heaven. So you can then make the point, well, if you're not perfectly holy when you die, but you will be perfectly holy when you're in heaven, then you must have some kind of purification between death and heaven that makes you perfectly holy. Now, it may not take a lot of time. It may happen just in an instant, in the twinkling of an eye, to use a phrase from the Bible. It may not take place in any special location. But there does seem to have to be some kind of purification that happens between death and heaven if you're still prone to sin in this life and you're not prone to sin in heaven. And can we agree on that? And if they think about it, Lutherans will typically say, yeah, we can agree on that. And then you can say, well, that's what we call purgatory as Catholics. That's what it is. It's the final stage of our purification where God makes us perfectly holy and ready to be with him in heaven. We don't claim that it takes any amount of time in particular. It could be instantaneous. We don't claim that it takes place in any particular location in the afterlife. It may not. We're not really told. But we do know that there is some kind of final stage to our purification that God does to us by the grace of Jesus Christ. And that's what we call purgatory. So even though Lutherans don't use the name in their theology, they can typically be, you know, talked with and dialogued with in a way that they'll understand that, oh, this concept actually makes sense, even though our theological tradition doesn't use the name for it that Catholics use.
Josh, I hope it's helpful. I'm going to leave it there because, as I said, I want to get as many people in before we have to go. Let's go to Therese. I don't have a location for you, Therese, but are you there with us, Therese?
Yes, I am.
Pretty quickly, your question for Jimmy.
So I belong to a parish that has been a vital parish. Mm-hmm. This goes into a question that was asked several callers back about the differences in parishes. Okay.
Just so you know, we're getting really close to the end. What's your question?
And it's always been known for itself. It was just a fabulous parish. And we have since, I've seen many parish pastors come and go, and the pastor or the parish has always been strong.
Okay, Therese, we've got to have a question.
Well, the new pastor has changed everything.
Okay.
He's changed the music. He's changed.
Okay. He's changed a bunch of stuff. What's the problem?
Is your question, what can you do about that, or am I in the ballpark, Therese?
Well, I know are leaving the parish while all of the young people are flooding in. And my question is, I understand we need to get the younger people in. What is a person like me to do?
Okay.
Well, I would say a number of things. And, you know, unfortunately, we didn't have more time to explore all the dimensions of the question. But based on the information we were able to get on the table, I would say that that one wants to pray about the situation. One wants to, in one's own heart, be open to, you know, different things. One wants to recognize that the church does need to bring in young people in the future. It can't cater exclusively to one group, but that also means that it needs to find a balance because it can't cater exclusively to young people either. It needs to care for people who are at a different stage of life. And so I would say, you know, try to be open, try to be reasonable, try to discuss it with, you know, you mentioned people are leaving, and if they're going to another parish, that's not necessarily a problem. If they're just going to one that's more to their liking, that's okay. You can go. You can fulfill your Sunday obligation at any Catholic parish. So, but if people are being alienated from the church, where they're not going to another parish, talk to them. You know, don't just pray for them, but also talk to them and say, "Hey, you know, I understand, and my preferences aren't for this either, but you know, we do need to take account. We need to find a balance here. If you think that there are other tweaks that the pastor could make, like maybe put a few things back the way they were to help win over some long timers, talk to the pastor about it. Just be reasonable and respectful. You may need to talk to the bishop if there's a big problem, but just try to be prudent and reasonable and charitable, and don't get alarmed by every single change, but try to find a balance.
Thanks very much, Therese, for that question. I hope that that was helpful. Jimmy Akin, thank you for a couple great hours.
My pleasure. Anytime.
You can find Jimmy at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. That's his podcast. All of his books are at shop.catholic.com. The latest one is Teaching with Authority. And tomorrow, hey, join us. We got 2 hours with Trent Horn tomorrow. But don't worry, it's going to be good anyways. It's, oh, wait, that didn't come out right.
Ooh.
My bad. Oh, excuse me. Wait, oh.